It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the Fox Valley. This is a hub for the paper industry with a long tradition, Wisconsin being the nationwide leader in the number of mills here. Green Bay Packaging opened a new one last year, achieving net zero water validation. We check in on its sustainability practices with your questions. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Bauer-Lotto is Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. And on behalf of Green Bay Packaging, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share on our business.
Yes. So let's talk about the company's footprint first. Green Bay Packaging, in the midst of this growth and expansion, why build new paper mills at a time when other mills are shutting down, especially here in Wisconsin?
I think our company in the third generation has been here since the 30s, and it was a traditional steeping in the history of the family to retain and invest and continue with the community with Green Bay. So the investment in the new mill was to help also for our customer base and to be responsive to market and provide the quality products for many more generations to come.
You're also doing this around the country. When you build or refurbish a plant, say, whether it's in Fort Worth or Tulsa or here, you know, Green Bay or Ohio, are you able to change systems enough to significantly reduce emissions?
We look at designing to include the environment. So we do take into when we can, because sometimes that can be challenging, but we do put energy efficiencies, and we also do water reductions and recycling on site to reduce those footprints. We also do internalize our scrap system, so there's less particulate matter. So we do things to improve our footprint, including wastewater treatment plants throughout our business footprint to making our products.
Let's look at that wastewater treatment in Green Bay. The new mill is a certified net zero water user. What does the certification mean?
Well, the certification, you know, is a third-party verification that our system is what we say it is, and it allows our customer base and transparency in the citizenry that reduces and reclaims the water and replaces otherwise fresh water from the intake from the city or from the Great Lakes, so that also reduces the footprint. So it is something that gives assurance that our commitment to sustainability, and with our customer base too, it assures them what our alignment is with our sustainability achievements.
Can you walk us through the process and what the proximity to the Green Bay Metropolitan Sewerage District, what that means to this operation?
So with the net zero water, with our wastewater municipality, which is about a half mile, quarter mile down the road, that was part of the logistics that provided this opportunity. It takes water, our water, we have no intake or discharge directly to the river, and so we...
The Fox River.
Mm-hmm. To the Fox River, yes. And we are able, when we send our discharge to them, we treat it with an anaerobic digester because the strength would be too strong. But we also send it to them, and then we have a split stream. When they discharge it to the river, they're actually sending water to us, and we are taking more than 1 million gallons a day on that. And so that helps us reuse. So we take wastewater and further treat it to allow us to reuse it in the paper making process instead of fresh water. So we have on site a lot of treatment, anaerobic digesting, reverse osmosis, and ultrafiltration that allows us to do that. So that's what that reclaimed. And the net zero water is the water balance. So we are taking alternate water of that reclaimed water as an alternate source to what would be fresh water from the city treated or pulled from the Great Lakes. So we're actually using more of that than we are the other in the way of how it is balanced. And that's what that net zero water validation through certification, they come on site and through all the, it's actually measured through pump meters.
And you've had that certification, that validation for over a year now. Is the system working as you intended? Have you encountered any challenges?
Yes, it is working as we expected. There was some shakedown, obviously, when you have something of this scale and size, and we're the first, you know, to do this at a mill, especially like in North America. We have the, you know, the, like you said, the first validation of it in the world. It is working. I mean, we have a 30% less water per ton of product produced, and it allows us to be able to recycle and do all those achievements on site with it. And it also reduces our BOD, biological oxygen demand, and suspended solids because of the efficiency of our on-site treatment and the municipality's treatment. So we have a significant, you know, probably 70-80% reduction of sediment that would otherwise go to the Fox River is not, because it's being collected through these systems. So it is working. It allows us to use that reclaimed water in our process, and it's been like last year was our first full year, mm-hmm. and that's where we can identify a lot of these achievements and measure on a year-to-year basis.
Lisa Bauer-Lotto with us, Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging, as we talk about a Wisconsin paper mill reducing its environmental footprint. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa, you mentioned the Fox River. Of course, decades ago, paper mills drew water from the Fox River, discharged, used water back into the river, and these discharges contained PCBs, the toxic chemicals, and that prompted the massive cleanup effort that has concluded. What is your mill doing differently from the past practices that caused these environmental problems?
Well, ours is a 100% recycled mill, so we didn't necessarily have additives or certain things that would directly contribute to it. It was more of a pass-through on that. We do a rigorous, we have a supply chain integrity, so we review our raw materials for those particulates of different chemistry, emerging chemistry, to ensure that it's not coming in. And we evaluate so we're not intentionally adding either in our chemistry or any applications and coatings.
You had mentioned sediment in the Fox River. I think it was TSS, total suspended solids. Why do we need to monitor this type of sediment in the Fox River? What is the concern there?
The concern is whenever you have additional loading, it can impair, which is this impaired waterway. Fox River's impaired waterway for TSS and BOD. It can inhibit or be detrimental for the water fish, but also the biodiversity of the water to have that. So when you have that sediment there, it can add more challenges to that environment. So when we can remove it, when we do remove it, it is a benefit to the water resource to the community.
And you see that happening now with, what is the connection to pulp and paper processes with sediment? Help us explain that.
Well, it depends on the process, and every mill is different, and every industry is different in how they use the water. To your point, early
sure.
when you draw the water in and use it and you return it, how you use it, if you're using it as a pressure water seal and you don't really add, or you're bringing it through your paper making and you treat it in a wastewater treatment plant. So there's different processes, and depending upon if it's contact with the fiber or how that is made, because there's some mills up along here that have a craft where they are digesting the fiber. So some of those residuals can be taken through. They have wastewater treatment, but some can continue on depending on their size and the tertiary or secondary treatment level of removal. So it's a process contact.
I see. You've talked about the paper mill becoming the first of its kind in the world for net zero certification. What does this standard mean for the future of the paper industry up and down the Fox River?
Well, it provides, a spearhead opportunity for people to replicate it. It may be at the same scale or smaller scale internally. And so it's a goalpost. It gives the opportunity that when one does it, the others can look to see if the technology and availability for their fit to do it as well.
Lisa Bauer-Lotto, Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging, producing materials that are used to make shipping boxes. Call in now with a question about paper mills and industry practices. Call 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the sustainability practices of Green Bay Packaging, located in a papermaking nexus, the Fox River Valley, home to a number of paper mills. Call in with comments on the sustainability of the manufacturing processes. Call in with a question about papermaking, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Bauer-Lotto is Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging and stays with us. Lisa, walk us through the process. Green Bay's mill taking recycled products from 99% water to create container board. Giving us a visual of this process, how does it work?
Well, we get old corrugated containers either from curbside or for businesses. They come in bales, and then they are broken down just like a hay bale into the process, and water is added, heat, and some chemistry to help break it down. And then we add additional chemistry for the fibers to align to get the strength. And that is pulped and mushed into like an oatmeal. Then it is put on the wire, shaking wire on the front of the machine, which is 99% water, 1% fiber. And then it continues like on a conveyor belt, goes through various roll presses and other dryers, and it compacts that down to removing the water. So then you end up with the paper at the end with like 8% moisture. And that's how that process is made.
Those bales, I would imagine, have to not have any contaminants as well. They have to be the material you need in order to recycle. Is that a challenge?
We have, through our procurement system, there's different grade qualities, and we have a higher grade quality that requires less than 2% contaminants. And so we watch for that because that makes our process less efficient, and there's more waste generation, and that's so we do have a program in place for that.
Let's bring on a call. Jane in Suamico has a question. Jane, hi, go ahead.
Appreciate Green Bay Packaging and all they've done for the Green Bay community and that they're expanding and bringing jobs here. I do have a question about PFAS forever chemicals. I know that surfaces of cardboard can be slick, they can be made slick, and that those chemicals used to make them slick have contained PFAS in the past. And I'm wondering what processes are used for monitoring PFAS.
Jane, thank you. Yes, Lisa, go ahead.
A good question. Well, the PFAS in ours for the corrugated has been actually out for some time. That they did at one point for coatings for water resistant and slip resistance and stuff, but those have been transitioned out for some time. And so a lot of the mills have. I don't believe there's any mill in Wisconsin using it up to this point because they've transitioned out. It was used also for other packaging purposes.
How recently was it phased out?
It's, you know, the industry for manufacturing has phased out with the longer chain to the shorter change and then to the different countermeasures. So it's been, it depends on your use. It could be a couple years. It could have been a year. It could have been, it kind of depends on how you used it in the packaging. Because it may have phased out a lot sooner to just even the manufacturer.
How much of an issue is PFAS in the pulp and paper industry right now?
I think we're monitoring it. You know, as an industry, we're conscious of the emerging chemistry, and we monitor it in our different ingredients and stuff like that. It's definitely something we are watching, you know, similar to other things we're implementing self-industry standards to reduce it and minimize it. So we're very active in watching on that. And the EPA recently here in the last year for the effluent limits guide had determined based on data submitted and analytical data that they are not authoring a wastewater guide for because of the lower amounts compared to other industries and such. So it's something that we're very conscious of and
self-monitoring within the industry.
In our products, in our water, and following. It's a very emerging topic, just even on the analytical, because that in itself is trying to keep up with the awareness of it, and sometimes that technology of monitoring, because some of the standards limits are lower than the detection limit of some of the analytical methods, so it's catching up. There's a little bit of a catch-up going on.
Lisa Bauer-Lotto with us, Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging, as we look at the processes of making paper. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa, I want to turn to energy. Green Bay Packaging makes 100% recycled cardboard, and you use natural gas boilers to avoid coal. Could renewable energy sources like wind or solar be used to power the mill's needs?
So the wind and solar, you know, is difficult to energize and provide the power at the level it needs for sun and wind because the technology for storage is not there at this time. Mm. So you have to have so much available at the time it starts up. And so and in time, that technology will be there. And I'm sure the power in the paper industry will look at those when those opportunities become available. We do at our mill here have a renewable energy on site. We are capturing the gas off the anaerobic digester and we are utilizing it. We put a generator in last year, so we are using that renewable biogas to power the effluent treatment plant on site. So we're one of the first that I'm aware of that are capturing all of it, fully capturing it. Others, industries typically flare it off because it's easier. Mm. So that was something that our company did because it was the right thing to do, and that doesn't mean it's always easier, the less expensive route. We also use that renewable biogas to replace natural gas, not in 4%. So we are utilizing as much on-site as we can.
Tim in Hollandale called in to ask you, has anyone looked at using hemp instead of trees for paper production?
Yes, there's always looking for alternative. You know, we have trade association, but we also have universities and stuff looking into always the hemp. There's bamboo. There's other different type of seagrass, straw, always looking at ways to utilize other renewable fibers for that. But, you know, also the trees, when we are tree farms, we are tree planters, just like a crop, just like a corn crop. We plant it like a crop because we are dependent on it and we're a steward of that as well. But yes, we are always looking at other alternatives as well. And the new mill here uses mixed paper, which is a newer innovation across the paper industry, where that is office paper newsprint that otherwise don't have markets to put into a product. Mm-hmm. We are incorporating it into our product.
I want to turn to your work in Fort Worth, Texas, where your new super plant is under construction, expected to start operation this year. Why build the plant in Texas rather than Wisconsin?
Our central is in Wisconsin, but we are throughout the Midwest. We have 4,500 employees, 36 locations, and that's part of some of our market supplying to our customer base. And when you can have that more localized and not the logistics, you know, so that helps supply that. So that plant's on schedule to be, it's completing construction here. It should be open shortly.
Will
to serve our customer base.
Will that super plant have additional sustainability practices that you see up here in Green Bay?
Yes, with the wastewater treatment, you know, for the removal and on the water, there's also the scrap system internalized, and there's other energy efficiencies as well. And so we always, on our capital projects, whenever we can, put those energy efficiencies in. Like with the mill up here, we implemented a lot of them that avoid electricity of 13,900 homes per year. So we do look at all the top end technology at the time that we build to put in those, reduce the energy and also energy technologies.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Lisa Bauer-Lotto is Corporate Director of Environment and Sustainability at Green Bay Packaging. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in now with Wisconsin CEOs from time to time. And, you know, you could say this corner office is pretty sweet. Sam McDaniel is CEO of Fortune Favors. This is a Madison-based candied nut company, formerly known as Nutcrack. And it's in the midst of a growth period. Share your thoughts. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. Good morning. Your company is in this growth trajectory over the past several years. What challenges do Wisconsin companies face in growing from a regional to national presence?
Yeah, it's quite a process. You know, we're 5 years old next week. We've actually been on the very lucky side of things. We are incredibly well supported. My partners, Eric Rupert and Jess Benish, founded the company. And these pecans that Eric created are incredibly delicious and memorable. So people have helped us along the way. I mean, every startup and every food startup has a set of the same challenges that have been multiplied to much more difficult in the past few years. Challenges with the supply chain, challenges with funding. We're very simple, and we are also, because we have a retail location as well, we were what they call in the business omni-channel before a lot of people were. So we sell at our own direct retail, we sell on the internet, we sell in wholesale. So some of the things that happened over the pandemic in the past few years, we were a little bit insulated from, and we were able to not have to go out in the world and seek so much funding from other people. We still hold 97% of the company, the three of us. And then as you're trying to get out into the broader world, you know, the consolidation in the grocery business and the proliferation of companies like us, there's never been a more small consumer packaged goods companies starting at the same time than there is right now, which is really cool. But there's a lot of competition to get into a relatively small number of companies who control most of the national distribution. So that is always, that's a challenge as well. You know, like I said, we're very lucky. We have an incredible product that people remember after the first time they try it. So we have a little bit of a cheat code.
I'm going to get into the supermarket shelves in just a moment, but I also want to highlight the fact that candy production is a big business and that your candy made from nuts, essentially. Does that give you an advantage to other candies that don't have any, like, nutritional value?
I mean, we would classify ourselves a lot more of a nut than a candy. You know, our nuts are only 7% sugar by weight. So when we're selling to people, we are talking a lot about health benefits. You know, you'll find pecans on the American Heart Association's top 10 list of the best things you can eat for your health. And our product is mostly pecan. So yeah, we definitely have an advantage there. And we talk about it all the time. One of the things that Eric did differently in creating this product is that process that puts a lot less sugar onto the nut. When people see them, you can tell, you know, it's a visual test that is very easy. It just looks like a pecan that's shiny. So we are not really, I mean, we are competing with those candy companies, but we don't have to compete on that. People can see quickly that we win.
Your company is changing its name from Nutcrack to Fortune Favors. Does the name change risk hurting your sales in existing markets while trying to expand into new ones?
Yeah, that definitely is a risk. We felt like it was the correct risk to take. And some of the stuff I've mentioned so far helps us with that. One, our product is so memorable and so good that we are convinced that our fans right now are not going to go away because of a name and packaging change. And we think that the changes that we're making open up a whole larger universe of opportunity for us too. You know, we know that one of the biggest challenges for any company like ours is to get people to remember you. There's all the studies, you know, people have to see something on their grocery shelf 7 times before they remember it. We get that the packaging that we're moving to is much more memorable in a traditional packaging sense. I'm going to turn into a little bit of a consumer packaged goods nerd here for you. We have our previous packaging was really fun and really cool. But it wasn't unified. We had 3 different flavors and each label looked kind of different and they weren't very obvious as to what was inside the can. Now we're moving into a setup where people can tell right away the packaging is uniform across the 3 flavors and the other ones that we have that we hope to launch in our life later. And it creates this incredible billboard effect on the shelf. So people who have shopped us in their grocery store already will see it and it's pretty obvious that it's still us. And the other thing is that more than 99% of the country, even if everyone in Wisconsin knows us, we have 99% of the market left to go. So we know that that's going to be something where people will get the chance to try it now and see it. And it's going to be, the product is still just as good. So while it is a risk, we're not really worried about that component of it.
What is your advice to companies that are considering whether to make a big name change or a big change in their look with the goal of reaching bigger markets? What would you say?
I would say that the feedback from your customers is the number one thing, both on your formulation and the taste profile, and then the packaging as well, and to not be afraid to change. Mm-hmm. You know, iteration is the key here. You know, I talk with our team and my partners all the time. We want to make as many mistakes as we possibly can. You know, that's how we learn about everything. And it takes a while to get to a point where people are going to remember, honestly. You know, we have this set of fans in Wisconsin that are, and, you know, the upper Midwest mostly, that are incredible. And we know that some of them are already telling us they liked our old stuff better, but they also are not going anywhere. They're saying, we still love it. We love Nutcrack and we love the surfer on the can. But the bigger risk is to not be willing to change. You know, that's what happens with a lot of small companies like us, is that they get pretty far down the spending road and it's too late. So I would say be willing to make iteration after iteration after iteration. And if you feel like it's the time, to go ahead and do it sooner than later, and to listen to the people who buy your product. I mean, it's nice to get advice from friends and to get advice from other industry professionals, but the people who buy your product are the ones who are going to decide what happens.
Sam McDaniel is CEO of Fortune Favors, formerly known as Nutcrack, as we talk about the expansion of this Madison-based flavored pecan company. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Sam, can you explain where your pecans come from? Are they made in Wisconsin? What is your supply chain like?
Yeah, so pecans are grown all over the southern half of the United States. We are pretty picky about where we buy from. In the past, I'd say 3 years, all of our pecans have come from one family growing operation in New Mexico. We are expanding that a little bit this year. It basically, as other commodities, it depends on where the crop is best. So we're going to have a lot of Georgia pecans in the production year that's about to start. We look at it kind of like a traditional fiscal year. We don't run on that, but like June to May is when we switch over. But one of those two states, and then you throw Texas in there, that's the majority of the pecans that are produced in the U.S. And so we're going to be in there. We want to make sure that we're getting the right size, species, and flavor profile. So we have a broker that we're partnered with who helps us with that. And we try to keep things as close together as we can too. So there's not big changes in the physical pecan in the can. But it's also, you know, it's an agricultural product, so we don't always get to decide.
Along those lines, gluten-free foods, there's a lot more awareness now. How do you approach the shift toward gluten-free candies and candied nuts?
We embrace it wholeheartedly. You know, it wasn't something that we set out to do. It's one of the things, again, this is the genius of what Eric created. You know, we're naturally gluten-free. Our ingredient list is so short, and our classic product only has 4 ingredients. And then when you add the seasonings and our spicy and our everything season, that's all that we use. So we didn't have to remove anything to be gluten-free. And we love the idea that it's more expansive and open to more people. You know, that's really the whole point of our company, is to bring joy to people through food. And the more people who can enjoy our products, the better. And so we have stuck with that. I mean, again, not difficult because there's no gluten in candy pecans generally, but it's something that we are going to stick with for the long term.
You mentioned Eric Rupert, the chef. You also have a chief operating officer. What are the advantages of co-owning a business, of maintaining this leadership structure as you expand?
Yeah, I think we feel very lucky. I mean, there are definitely challenges, but the advantages far outweigh. The three of us, it's a pretty flat decision-making process amongst the three of us. And what we found is that the support that we can provide to each other is much more important than the difficulty of sometimes of getting three strong-willed people to agree. You know, you go through something like the pandemic that all businesses just went through, and it's really difficult for everybody to be operating at peak capacity all the time. You know, we all have children, we all have spouses, we all have the rest of our lives. And so Eric will talk about this all the time. We joke about it. You know, there isn't a day when two of us aren't picking up the third and helping. And that part has been a really big deal for us. And you'll hear from a lot of folks that, you know, having three people in that decision-making is going to make your business less nimble and, you know, harder to move forward. And I mean, every once in a while we'll see that, but again, the advantages outweigh the other side of it. And then when we think about trying to have a full life, how to be able to do the rest of the things that we all want to do in our lives while still running a successful startup company, that trio makes that possible. You know, we have lots of friends who do it as a solo founder and CEO, and sometimes the only employee, and we, you know, congratulate anybody who can handle it. We are honest with ourselves and say, that's too much. We need the help and support that we get from the other two people in the trio.
Sam McDaniel is CEO of Fortune Favors. It's formerly known as Nutcrack, headquartered in Madison. You can share what's on your mind at any point in the discussion. Call in with a question about the candied nut business and its expansion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What does it take to scale up in the candied nut business? We get that perspective from CEO Sam McDaniel at Fortune Favors, headquartered in Madison, a new production facility up and running in nearby Cottage Grove. Join in with a question or a comment. Call 800-642-1234. Sam, looking at this Cottage Grove production facility, your company aiming to produce more than 1 million pounds of products by 2027, how can a small business here in Wisconsin figure out if the markets exist for expansion before spending all the upfront costs of additional production?
Oh, that's a great question, Kate, and a difficult one. I will say one of the things that in this a day and age that we're very lucky is that this information is definitely out there and more available than it's ever been. It used to be that people had to buy all this data from one of the big data companies, Nielsen or one of those. The startup community that exists in the food business now is really robust, and it's really all about getting out there and networking and meeting people who do the same thing. The Madison Milwaukee corridor is a hotbed of small food businesses, and there are organizations that bring us all together. There's a lot of communication and collaboration. And a lot of times you can get that information there. You can get connected to the larger retailers who can help you with that. You can find other businesses who have walked this path before. And that's really it. I mean, I guess maybe it's sort of a cliche to say that networking is the key, but that really is it, is finding people who have done this before and can help you make that choice. And then finding partners on the business side of things who can help you navigate that as well on the financial side.
You mentioned retailers, you know, space on supermarket shelves being finite. How do you do that? What is challenging to get the products onto supermarket shelves?
It is an incredible challenge. And at the highest levels, it's incredibly expensive too. You know, we talk with people who tell us that to launch a single product in a national grocer, if you think of Kroger and all their banners, one single facing is going to cost you $1 million or $1.5 million to launch. Starting smaller and using some of the retailers who are more focused on small brands is really the way. The members of the co-op movement are a huge help. And we have a plethora of great local grocers in Wisconsin. The Metcalf's folks have been incredible for us. And it's really about getting people to try your product and getting them to help you do the work to get your customers to go in and say, hey, we would love it if you carried Fortune Favors. We love this product. We know Sam and Eric and Jess, you know, and then you have a base to build from there. And then using often the local programs, we got into Whole Foods through their local producer program. And that has been, that's still the number one banner in the country where people discover new products in categories like ours. So getting into those local programs where you can almost guarantee support. You know, we knew people were going to go to Madison and Milwaukee Whole Foods and buy our product, so we could tell the Whole Foods people that, and that lowers the risk on their side, and that's a big key.
So those local grocers that really have an eye on locally owned companies and really is an on ramp.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's the we literally wouldn't be here without that set of people here in Wisconsin. Like I said, the people at Metcalf's and the Willie Street Co-op here in Madison. You know, it allows for, you need your local platform to be really strong before you can go bigger. I mean, if you have unlimited funding, then that's a different story, but we're not in that category. And so you get those people who are advocates and cheering for you, and those people at the retailers too, because a lot of folks who work in that business, and I speak from experience, my wife and I did for a long time, you know, part of the reason they do the jobs that they do is they want to champion brands like us. They want to help. They have a passion for introducing their customers and the world to great local food. And that's really, those are the people that are selling for us. You know, they're like a part of our company. We really, that's how we approach it.
Let's look at government aid on a path to stability and growth. Are you seeking financial aid from state or federal government programs that would help job growth?
Yes. Yeah. So we, that is a big part of how the job growth part of it, and then making sure we use all the resources available to us. We received an economic injury disaster loan during the pandemic when we had to shut down our retail shop. And then more on the support front for us is the Small Business Administration and the Small Business Development Center locally. In buying our new facility, we did use an SBA loan product, which we would not have been able to make that purchase without that. We had help from, I mentioned, the Small Business Development Center, which is a resource that any small business, not just food, if you're not aware of it, that is one of the best things you can possibly do, is your local branch of the University of Wisconsin. That's usually where they're housed. And they are here and funded to help us and brands like us to do what we're trying to do at no cost to us. And they helped us navigate that process, which is incredibly complicated. And then also finding a banking partner, which for us was Oak Bank in Fitchburg, who helped us with that SBA process. And again, there's no pathway that we're aware of for a brand that doesn't want to sell all your equity or have your own personal fortune in there, which we don't have anyway, then finding those partners and finding people who will help you figure out all of the, you know, the nooks and crannies of the government funding. And with the eye towards having a company that's sustainable and does create jobs and good jobs too. We're very proud of the employment that we provide and the how we pay our people and how we take care of them as a holistic approach too.
We're talking about a Madison-based flavored pecan company, Fortune Favors. Sam McDaniel here, CEO and formerly known as Nutcrack. You can join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. Sam, as you navigate those state and federal processes, how could state lawmakers or other entities help Wisconsin become a better place for expanding businesses, whether it's, you know, from startups and those angel investors or elsewhere in the process?
Yeah, I really think the looking at it from a cost of living and that sort of approach is really the key. You know, we need the most difficult thing for all of us right now is finding and hiring people. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's really difficult for people to afford to live in some of the cities where a lot of this startup action is happening. And, you know, everything is so politically divided, you know, but for a small business like us, it's the total package. It's having childcare available for employees. It's having public transportation so people can get to work. It's having accessible funding for companies that are doing the right things as far as how they approach their hiring, you know, paying a living wage and providing benefits and not gatekeeping that stuff only to the large companies who can afford to lobby for it. Basically, it's to, you know, to take this giant swath of people that we have that are starting small businesses and really the engines of the economy and give them help to make sure that they can get the people and not have all of the funding go to these larger companies. I think that's really it. A lot of times it's like the idea is that lower taxation is going to help everybody the most, that the companies will be able to then reinvest that money. But, you know, we're not a massive company where a lower tax rate is going to be the thing for us. Providing childcare for our employees so they can do what they want to do as far as their work life is really a much bigger deal.
Inflation, you know, we see inflation rates higher as the Federal Reserve, you know, inches up interest rates. How concerned are you about expanding in this economic climate?
I would be lying to say that we're not concerned. I mean, we're in a product category that is a little bit less sensitive to that, just because we're a premium product anyway. And those, you know, I guess sort of sadly in the world, the higher end is actually a little bit more protected, and in the demographics that we often sell to. But really the only thing that we can do is continue to push forward and try to do the best job that we can at what we're doing and to be really close with our retail partners, the folks that help us sell our product, and our financial partners like our bank, to make sure that we're talking about all of this. You know, we try very hard to be way ahead of any kind of problem that we see, and we are very communicative with our banking partners
about really
what we think is going to happen.
Shoring up all those relationships. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Sam McDaniel is CEO of Fortune Favors, formerly known as Nutcrack. It's headquartered in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.